Okay. Virtue in the way of the world. I won't dwell on this argument in the way I have the previous two. In fact, the general form of the argument here is fairly well known, since it forms the germ, although he never says so, of McIntyre's After Virtue. In fact, he wrote, the whole of After Virtue was just a working out of this section all by itself. Namely, that what goes by the name of virtue for us, and for McIntyre that's all of modern morality, is really nothing but fragments of an earlier practice which have lost their meaning because they have lost their original setting. That is, McIntyre supposes, and Shaftesbury was probably at issue here, that what gives meaning to our moral concepts was something of the role they had in an earlier form of life that has now disappeared and gotten internalized in the individual. And when they are so internalized, they have a feeling of both being rational and at the same time, in some sense, mysterious. So McIntyre took seriously the idea of lost ethical life. Indeed, he says we have to just go back to Aristotle. He says the place where that lives now is roughly in South Bend, Indiana. That's a virtuous community. But what we get when we're missing the form of life that would go with it is something that we can call virtue idealism, which is to say it's modern virtue without the communal supports necessary for it to actualize itself in the world. So virtue, because it's a kind of idealism, Hegel will speak of the night of virtue, with, I guess, a paragraph 386, and it's tempting to think he, you know, is playing a bit with Don Quixote. Shaftesbury seems an obvious person here. Harris thinks it's Lessing. I don't know which of any of these it is. But the thought is something like this. The idea now is that individuality is not immediately in possession of universality or necessity, but that individuality must overcome itself in order to attain to a certain type of moral necessity, and that this new form of universality is acting virtuously, and that virtue is therefore a kind of discipline of the self, in which when the self does manage this, right, the idea would be that it will find in acting virtuously, in seeking its own pleasure, it will always also be finding the good for everyone. Now, such a virtue when achieved understands itself as opposing the way of the world, Weltlauf, where the way of the world is a social reality that is perverted by, amongst other things, rampant individualism. and then we have a kind of individualism that seeks its own pleasure and enjoyment, kind of hedonism and egoism. So here, individualism arises for the first time as a problem for moral consciousness. Now, because this is a kind of virtue idealism in which virtuous action and behavior lack the complex set of social practices in which each, when McIntyre's story, just to remind you, virtue always relates to specific kinds of practices, and these practices have their own internal goods. To say their internal goods is to say that there is a certain pleasure involved in performing them well. So he always uses, as does Plato and Aristotle, analogies from areas of virtuosity, like playing the piano well. That is, you receive a certain kind of pleasure, right, when you participate in a practice and learn to master it, because internal to the practices are goods internal to it qua practice. And the assumption of Aristotle is that Greek ethical and political practices are like that. That is, they have their own internal goods. We don't have those practices, therefore we don't have goods internal to the practice. Hence, virtue becomes just a matter of virtuous character, that is, a form of moral consciousness. That's why Hegel says that virtuous consciousness is a kind of faith. That kind of indicates that it's been internalized. Because it sets itself against the world, or the way of the world, as cynical, self-seeking action, then the only reality possible for this kind of virtuous activity is for it to be recognized as virtuous. That is, it's a kind of self-satisfaction in behaving well. I guess I always think of this kind of person as the moral prick. Right? The kind of person who feels utterly justified in their life because they support all the right causes and go on all the right marches and have a sense of their perfection thereby achieve virtue. So this is an idealism of the worst kind, and that means that in the showing of itself in opposition to the world, and for Hegel, this very fact, let's call this form of moral priggishness, shows its lack of seriousness. It's not a matter that the world has actually gotten better or not. It's not that any work has been realized. It's that I've done virtuous. So, paragraph 386. So virtue, like heart, is more interested in itself, in its showing of itself, than what is accomplished. And therefore, it can have this shape simply because the bite of this shape, and this is the why it's self-undermining, the bite of this shape is the way it shows itself in opposition to the world. That is, its virtue only appears as a contrast of term, I'm virtuous and the world aims, and that's its existential emptiness. So paragraph 389 is the core of the critique. He says, virtue therefore is conquered by the way of the world because its purpose is in fact the abstract unreal essence, appearing virtuous, and because its action as regards reality rests on distinctions which are purely nominal. It wanted to consist in bringing the good into actual existence by the sacrifice of individuality, but the side of reality is itself nothing else but the side of individuality. The good was supposed to be that which has an implicit being and to be opposed to what is, but the in itself, taken in its real and true essence, is rather being itself, etc., etc. So, it can't make sense of being, of actuality. And because it can't make sense of being or actuality, then not only does it not have any worth, but equally, it loses the force of particularity with which it started. Because here, there's no source for there to be any conflict or tension between the particular and the universal. It perfectly realizes the universal, and in that perfection, in that self-congratulation, it shows its emptiness, and it is an emptiness that, like Shaftesbury, who ended up as a Stoic, this ends up as a form of Stoicism in the face of the world, and like that earlier Stoicism, Hegel suggests that it collapses out of boredom. Its claim to virtue is the empty of the intoning of virtue without any encounter. If one's not keeping close track on Hegel here, then the next transition in paragraph 391 can be a bit surprising. He says, the result then, which issues from this antithesis, consists in the fact that consciousness drops like a discarded cloak its idea of a good that exists only in principle, but has as yet no actual existence. In its conflict, it has learnt by experience that the way of the world is not as bad as it looked. For its reality is the reality of the universal. That is, see the puzzle looked. If virtue is getting its authority from the contrast, right? It must be denying the world any form of rational authority, any universality worth having. But that can't be right, and it cannot be right because the reality of the world is nothing but the product of individual actions. And if reality of the world is nothing but the product of individual actions, of people trying to bring the good into the world, then the world has an incipient universality in it that cannot be thought of as merely opposed to the individual. That is, all the forms of individuals we've been looking at have been assuming that I have to imprint so that moral reality is here, right? And I've got to imprint it on an opaque or resistant or nasty empirical world, as if the empirical world is made up of anything other than individuals acting on the basis of their beliefs and desires and values. So that the contrast between self and world, called the representational contrast, right, is always illicit, because it does not recognize its participation in that very world. So Hegel says, with this lesson in mind, the idea of bringing the good into existence by means of the sacrifice of individuality is abandoned. For individuality is precisely, what is individuality, he says, is precisely the actualizing of what exists only in principle. And the perversion ceases to be regarded as a perversion of the good, for it is in fact really the conversion of the good as a mere end into its actual existence. The movement of individuality is the reality of the universal. The movement of individuality is the reality of the universal. What's the reality of the universal? It's what we do. We have ideas and we try to realize them in the world. And that's how the universal, that is, the world, meaning, comes into being. So the thought is, if virtue is illusory, then individuality cannot be either wholly cynical or intrinsically opposed to universality. Indeed, the way of the world cannot be all that bad, since even if it does not know it, it is a world, and that world both empowers the individual and is the result of individual action, which is what Hegel means when he says that the movement of individuality, including the forms we have been observing, is the reality of the universal. If we had not already heard earlier in this section something about Geist as a matter of customs and laws and practices and forms of recognition, we might think this was a bit of reductionism, with social is just only reductively individual doings. Hegel, of course, is not thinking of any version of reductionism here. Rather, he's thinking this as a question of content. Nonetheless, the position that one that now needs engaging is going to be a sophisticated version of the thought that the social is nothing but the production of individual actions, and those individual actions are to be understood as agents who are operating with, let's call it, ordinary means and rationality. in coming to realize that individuality is not necessarily opposed to the world, that worldly individualism is not itself opposed to universality, then it follows that in some sense, individuality and universality are themselves united. Which is why this section begins now, individuality, which takes itself to be real in and for itself. That there is no intrinsic conflict, although we haven't figured out how they're connected up, between individuality and universality. So the way of the world, we might say, is not intrinsically awful for Hegel. That the way of the world of bourgeois individualism itself has a kernel of rationality. Nor is individuality in seeking its own good intrinsically opposed to working for the good of all. So what we have, because no longer troubled by the opposition between individual and world, what we now have is a self-assured individuality that its meaning can be realized in the social world, and that it can just directly act on this individualistic basis in which individual action is everything. Action, therefore, paragraph 396. Action has therefore the appearance of the movement of a circle which moves freely within itself in a void, which unimpeded now expands, now contracts, and is perfectly content to operate in and with its own self. The element in which individuality sets forth its shape has the significance solely of putting on the shape of individuality. It is the daylight in which consciousness wants to display itself. Action alters nothing and opposes nothing. It is the pure form of a transition from a state of not being seen to one of being seen. And the content which is brought out into the daylight and displayed is nothing else but what this action already is in itself. So what we have here is in fact the liberal notion of social space as an arena of mutual self-realization. It's Mrs. Thatcher saying society does not exist, right? But individuals exist and produce society. Moment of Reagan, of von Hayek, of Popper, of all these strong forms of individualism that think that individuals doing their own thing is compatible with the construction of a habitable world, and that there's no demand opposing it. And hence, Hegel's going to call this the spiritual animal kingdom. Spiritual animal kingdom. Right? Because on the one hand, it's spiritual because it has got the relationship between individual and universality is being realized, but it's one in which it's an animal one because it is about self-realization. Because the universality has no moment of apartness. No difference. It's just whatever action brings about, and nothing else, and anything else would be an interference, right? Which is what the von Hayek argument is over and over again. Anything. Labor unions, laws, all of this gets in the way of people acting spontaneously in this self-moving circle. Now, this is... There's many moments in the phenomenology where some thinker or other wants to say, I think we can stop right here. For Feuerbach, we saw it with sense certainty. For Derrida, it was in the shift from biological to spiritual life. He thinks the way Hegel makes that shift, once you get dialectic going, it's never going to stop. And of course, Kantianism is nothing but saying we must stop with Kant and not go on to Hegel. That's all the Kantians say. That's their job. Rüdiger Bittner, in this wonderful book, What Reason Demands, is a splendid form of nominalism and skepticism and individualism, argues that it is in this very chapter one must stop, because, Bittner argues, if you go past this moment, the moment of the spiritual animal kingdom, you're going to end up in Kant. And he says, of course, once you go to Kant, you can't avoid going to Hegel. So we got to stop earlier than Kant in order to avoid Hegel. Otherwise, it's all lost. Now, what Hegel's going to argue here, and I won't do the argument since it's getting late, but let me say how the argument's going to run and get it going, and I'll start here next week. What Hegel's going to argue here, and Bittner deny, is that the idea of reason as simply what helps me realize my overall life plan could not count as a reason unless the good reasons for action, in order to qualify as such, fit into a supra-individual context of meaning. Let me say that again. The argument is, and the best account of this, by the way, is Pippin's article, You Can't Get There From Here, Transition Problem in Phenomenology, in the Cambridge Companion to Hegel. The argument is going to be that the idea of reason that simply helps me realize my overall life plan, let's call that prudential reason. And Bittner actually doesn't use a narrow version of it. He thinks he helps himself to an Aristotelian version. But prudential reason, means ends rationality in some generous form, that's what's at issue here. Hegel's argument is that kind of reasoning could not count as a reason unless the good reasons for action, in order to be good reasons, fit into a supra-individual context of meaning, namely Geist, spirit. So what this means here is that nothing could conceivably count as a reason for me, unless I understand myself as also counting for and participating in something larger and more significant than my life. Kip puts it, little old me. That, so here's, and this is why this is a really testing point. The question is, can we make sense of our own lives in purely individualistic terms, find rational self-reassurance for ourselves in this way? Or is it, and this is the moment where the necessity is going to really impel, or must I consider myself?
And the question is, what's the must here? And must I consider myself in order to be rational for myself
in my own prudential reasoning,
see myself as part of some larger whole? So here, exactly, the moment of, as it were, individualism versus Geist is being posed. Once you get past this meaning, this moment, then you're into forms of universality, even in this chapter. Moral rationalism, all those are already saying, I must consider myself in relationship to my others. Here, prudential reasoning says, I don't have to worry about that, given that notion of action, right? Moves in a circle. If I just am a prudential, rational, happiness maximizer, things will take care of themselves. That's the question we want to ask ourselves. We'll start there next time. We will begin, just so I know we're already, I think, 3 weeks behind the third week of term. Pretty soon, we'll almost be at the point where we'll be able to begin the book. Just in shambles, I never get born. But I'm hoping to start Spirit next week. That is my intention.
Have a quick.